We were looking last night at the things that a father does and making a parallel idea there to Paul's ministry to the Thessalonians, how he acted like a father does. And he encourages and comforts and urges. And, of course, the goal is to live a life worthy of God. And then it says at the end of verse 12, who calls you into his kingdom and glory. So this morning we're going to be talking about the Father's goal in calling his children into his kingdom and glory. As we've been working our way into 1 Thessalonians, we've spent a pretty significant amount of time looking at Paul's focus on the importance of the behavior of the messenger in respect to the impact that the message makes on those who hear it. Because in chapter 1, he talks about the fact that in verse 5, he says, you know how we lived among you for your sake. And then he says a little bit further on, they tell how you turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God. And the whole point there is, it was the quality of the life of Paul and Silas and Timothy in the face of the Thessalonians that caused them to recognize the validity of the message. We have become, after a couple thousand years of Christianity, so-called, that we get kind of jaded. We hear these words, and yet we see people ignoring them completely, and even the people sometimes that are preaching them are ignoring them, and we get this strong impression that's really not true, or they'd be living that way, you know. And yet Paul and Silas and Timothy were actively living because they were under the gun all the time, and they had a commission to be spreading this gospel to every place. And when you're under the gun and you have a commission that you're committed to, your dependence on the Lord is daily, hourly, momentary, whatever. And the consequence of that is that the Spirit of God is free to produce a likeness of the life of Jesus through the physical bodies of those that are dependent on Him. And that makes people see the validity of it. So in chapters 2 and the first part of chapter 3 of this letter, he's on this thing about, you know what kind of men we were among you. You know, in verse 2, or chapter 2, he says in verse 2, we previously suffered and been insulted in Philippi, as you know. So it's all this as you know stuff. And then in verse 9, he says, surely you remember, brothers, our toil and hardship. So it's still about how we behave toward you. And then he says in verse 10, you're witnesses, and so is God, of how holy and righteous and blameless we were among you who believed. For you know that we've dealt with you, each one of you, as a father deals with his own children, encouraging, comforting, urging you to live lives worthy of God, who calls you into his kingdom and glory. And this long focus, and it goes on into chapter 3, raises kind of an issue because, especially in our generation, we have so many, quote, ministries that are basically impersonal. Their videos and their TV broadcasts and their radio broadcasts. And you never get to know the individual on a personal basis. You just hear the words or maybe see the person and hear the words. And in the larger context of 1 Thessalonians and the New Testament also, the focus on this business of having a messenger whose life impacts the people that are hearing it because they know the life issues is kind of challenging. There are lots and lots of people who come to faith because the message is delivered to them without any kind of on-hand messenger. Even the Gideon ministry is fundamentally committed to the idea of just putting the Bibles in motels and in jails and schools and all. Just give them the Bible. And there are all kinds of testimonies that come back to the Gideons about how somebody picked up one of their little testaments or one of their Bibles and they came to faith. And there wasn't any on-hand messenger there. It seems in this particular letter that Paul's focus creates kind of a strong argument for a conclusion that we kind of have to draw, that enduring vital hope. And remember, 1 and 2 Thessalonians are about hope. Galatians is about faith. 1 and 2 Thessalonians about hope. faith, hope, and then love. And of course, that's Ephesians, and we'll probably not be here long enough to cover Ephesians. But anyway, point is, it seems apparent that if you're going to have an enduring vital hope, it's somewhat dependent on a legitimate demonstration by the messenger of the legitimacy of the message. But on the other hand, especially in our time, an impersonal transmission of the truth is often the basis for somebody's faith, and it seems like it pulls Paul's focus out of focus. So what do we say to that? Does a person really need a personal demonstration, or can you have hope without it? The answer seems to be that Paul's teaching in this letter is what I would call proverbial. It's a proverb. It doesn't in any way set up a kind of hindrance to the grace of God. And what I mean by that is, a proverb, in all the book of Proverbs, many people turn the Proverbs into promises, but they're not. Just because it says, train up a child in the way he shall go, when he's old he won't depart from it, doesn't mean that that's a promise. It's like the proverb that says, if a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Well, Jesus' ways please the Lord, and his enemies killed him. So you have to understand that a proverb is not a promise. A proverb is simply a statement of the typical. It's typical that if you raise your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, that when they're old they won't depart from it. That's typical, but it's not a promise. And it's typical that if a man's ways please the Lord, it kind of puts oil on the water of turbulence with all the enemies, because they recognize that the guy doesn't want to do them damage or whatever. So a proverb is a proverb. That's just the typical way things work. And 1 Thessalonians is like that. Typically, the human messenger's lifestyle and impact is a part of the creation of people who live with a vital hope. But in a very real sense, God never actually, in a final way, he never rests the success of his plans on anybody but himself. It's true that he will use his children in the lives of others, but if those children want to be disobedient or unbelieving or drop the ball big time, that does not mean that what God is going to accomplish in the lives of those others will fall flat. It doesn't mean that, because God simply doesn't commit his enduring plans in any final sense to anybody but himself. That was Abraham's big lesson, Romans chapter 4. The one that makes a promise is the one who's obligated to keep it. Since God made the promise, up to him to keep it. Now, that he uses instruments and intermediate agents to keep his promises is a fact. He does all the time. But that doesn't mean he has to. So if the instrument's unwilling, or he drops the ball big time, then God just picks up the slack. And we're going to see that this morning. God's method of operation is established, rooted in the promise faith methodology. That's what Galatians is all about. And because when God makes a promise, his integrity is on the line, the one who makes a promise has to keep it. He can't rest the keeping of that promise on some weak vessel that might shatter when somebody leans on it. And so the whole point is, God has to have a two-pronged methodology. On one side of the issue, he uses people in the lives of people. And on the other hand, when people drop the ball, he takes up the slack himself. So, if every other person that I know is a bad example of faith and thus a destroyer of hope, my quality of experience in respect to the promise is just as solid as it ever was and just as satisfying as it ever was, because I trust in the one who made the promise, not in the instrument he might put in my path, or an oppositional thing that Satan might put in my path. There are gazillions of people who make their decisions about the integrity of the gospel because they see some Christian drop the ball real big. It doesn't work for them. I ain't interested. That's a huge mistake. That's why Jesus said, don't call anybody father on earth, because there's only one perfect Father. And what he meant by that was just don't make the mistake of letting the examples of human beings in a negative way destroy your own confidence in the promise that God has made. So with that in mind, I can live my Christian life with a vital hope if nobody else does. That's the song, "Though None Go With Me, I Still Will Follow." It's harder because you do start questioning yourself when everybody else is against you. But Noah stands as the classic biblical example of a man who stood against the entire culture of thousands and thousands and thousands of people who scoffed and mocked for 120 years. So you don't have to have somebody else, but it's nice to have somebody else. And what Paul is doing in 1 Thessalonians is simply reminding the Thessalonians, look, you have an example in us of people's lives who are motivated by hope. We don't let persecution and opposition and difficulties squelch our hope, because God's the one who made the promise. He will keep it. We're going to depend on that to happen. So God gives us other people as encouragers of our hope, but they're never supposed to take His place as the root of that hope. So we get to have friends and others who believe like we do, but we all know that friends and others that believe like we do often drop the ball and they show their feet of clay, and then what do we do with our hope? A lot of times we get all discouraged. Shouldn't do that. Because of this text, God is calling you into His kingdom and glory. And we're going to look at what that means. At the big T theological level, what I mean by big T is that talking about God Himself. Theological means about God, but some things are about God in His works. So you can talk about the theology of the church, for example. And that's about how the Bible teaches the church ought to function. But big T theology, in my thinking, is talking about God Himself. And at the big T theological level, this text says, God is calling you. He is calling us, and it's a present tense participle, which means it's an ongoing thing. It's a pretty constant activity. God doesn't just call us once. He doesn't just call us twice. He is calling us. The whole point of verse 12 is, Paul wants us to live lives that are worthy of God because He is calling us. And of course, that validates, I think, my claim that when the proverbial activity breaks down, when you don't have somebody who's demonstrating the excitement of the hope, that doesn't mean you can't have it. Because God is calling you. He's actively involved. God, in a very gracious way, is stepping up His immediate involvement to take up the slack of somebody who's dropping the ball and being an impediment to your hope. God is calling. He may use human instruments, and He may not. On one occasion, He used a donkey. But nonetheless, He may use circumstances, current circumstances, events that are going on, and He may not. Proverbs exist because God does have a typical mode of operation. His typical mode of operation is to use human instruments and current circumstances. But those are proverbial. That's the typical. It doesn't define everything God does. This text says there's something else in the picture. God is calling us. The question then is, what is the summons? The calling, He calls you. That's the verbal base for the word that we talked about last night and translated in the NIV, mistranslated, I think, encouraging. That's the summons alongside. Parakaleo is a combination word. Para is a preposition that means alongside, and kaleo is the verb that means to call. So you put the two together etymologically, and it was coined to refer to the idea of somebody calling to somebody out there to come alongside. Well, Paul has turned the entire gospel into a summons. God, by the gospel, summons people to leave where they are and come alongside Him. In the big picture of things, that's the concept of repentance and faith. But because he uses that parakaleo, we can recognize that when we read, if we were reading it in Greek, we would read, who calls you, as kale. It comes from kaleo. He is calling you. And of course, the implication is he's calling you alongside. He's calling you. But what does that really mean? What does it mean he's calling you? How do you hear God calling you? We can sing songs that are full of metaphor and not even understand the metaphors and enjoy the songs. Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face. Well, how do you do that? That's a metaphor. I mean, I can't see Jesus' face. How do you do that? It's a metaphor, and a lot of the metaphors leave us hanging. We don't know how to explain that. We use the language and we talk about it, but if somebody actually stops us and say, what do you really mean by that? We just kind of, hadn't thought about it. Just sounded good. It was a good religious, you know. So when it says that God is calling us, what does he mean? Are we supposed to be listening to a voice or something? Well, I don't think that that's the implication. It's pretty unusual, though not beyond the possibility. I mean, God could speak in English to us out loud where we could hear it. He could do that. There are occasions in history where he has done that. But if you took all of history, all of the thousands of years of human history, and took the few times that God actually audibly spoke out loud in the voice and the language of the person who was listening, how many do you suppose there'd be? I mean, of all of the people that were converted in the first century, how many of them heard Jesus say out loud in Hebrew, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? I mean, how many Pharisees do you suppose, how many of their lives would have been turned around if God had bothered to say out loud to them, what in the world do you think you're doing? That's not the typical. It's very unusual, and it usually causes some pretty unusual responses. And Apostle Paul was a very unusual response. He dominates the New Testament scene because he wrote most of it. The book of Acts is primarily about his ministry once you get beyond the initial chapters. So, since we don't expect, and that doesn't mean we deny, but we don't expect God to talk out loud. And so what do? We turn it into the still small voice. Well, what is that? Well, that's a metaphor that was built off of one experience that Moses had in the wilderness. Long years, thousands of years ago, where there was all kinds of racket going on, and God wasn't in any of the racket. And when all the racket was gone, he heard this still small voice. And for whatever reason, I've never figured out, modern preachers have taken that one isolated little thing and turned it into a metaphor of how God deals with all his children. He whispers in this still small voice. Well, honestly, how many times have you heard God whisper to you in a still small voice? What does that mean? Well, what most people means is they're pondering something and all of a sudden an idea pops into their mind. And to them, that's the still small voice of God. I don't have a problem with that. Except that it's a metaphor that doesn't, most people don't have that experience on a daily basis. I mean, how many times have you had a situation where you were kind of in a quandary and all of a sudden the answer just, how many times in your whole lifetime? Most of us could say, yeah, I've had that experience, but it's not the norm. It's not something every day. This verse says it's happening every day. God is calling you. It's a constant summons. Well, what's he saying? I think we'll see the answer as we go on into this issue of the worthy walk. He is calling you into his kingdom and his glory. What does that mean? Especially for people who have already believed the gospel. They've already been transferred out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light. They've already been given an inheritance, Peter says, that is reserved in heaven for them, undefiled and incapable of being shot or blown away or ruined. It's reserved in heaven for you, incorruptibly, your inheritance. So God has already converted these Thessalonians. He's already brought them to faith in Jesus. He's already given them an inheritance in the kingdom. He's already established it for them as an eternal hope for the future. So in what sense is he calling you into his kingdom and glory on a regular, consistent, present tense verb type of activity? Well, let's think about it along this line. The issues of a worthy walk are kind of complicated at the level of human participation. He wants us to walk lives worthy of God, who is calling us. And for every individual believer, that looks different. I mean, there are certain general characteristics of how believers ought to look. They ought to look like love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faithfulness, meekness, and self-control, because that's the fruit of the Spirit that's indwelling their body, that's producing the life of Jesus through them. But those are very general. Even love is a complicated concept. We could go on and on and on and on about the complications of love. What does love look like in all of the circumstances of a day? Well, it's going to look here like this, and it's going to look like that over there, because that circumstance is different and it calls for a different response. So at the level of human participation, a worthy walk is kind of complicated, because it's a summons, and it ought to go without saying. If he's calling us into a life that's worthy of him, because he's calling us into his kingdom and glory, it ought to go without saying that the first thing about a summons is that it requires a response. Even if the response is, like the kids do, I didn't hear mom calling me. They did, but they don't want to acknowledge it, because then they're responsible to respond. They know that. So what do? They act like they didn't hear it, because they think in their foolishness that that absolves them from having to respond in a positive way. In other words, they have to do what they're told. As long as I didn't hear it, I don't have to do it. Well, we don't leave that childishness just because we grow older. And the summons of God, the assumption of a summons is you've got to respond. And a summons really can't even exist without a response, even if the response is rejection. You can't reject what you didn't hear. You can't respond to something positively that you didn't hear. A summons says, you heard this. And the deepest question, or the deeper question, is, what does God expect me to do with his ongoing calling thing? And especially if he's not audible, and it may not even be an impression in my brain. What am I supposed to do if the still small voice doesn't pop up? Or if the loud verbal voice doesn't come out of heaven? What am I supposed to do? What sense is he calling me, and what does the call sound like? Well, I think that brings us to this issue of the idea of a worthy, living a life worthy. It's the definition of a worthy walk. So let's think for a minute about this idea of worthy. What does it mean for something to be worthy of something? Well, the basic idea of the word means that it actually fits the circumstance or the setting. There's a correspondence between the reality of the circumstance or setting and the activity that's going to fit that. For example, you're driving down Interstate 10, your tires have 60,000 miles on them, they're old, and all of a sudden, pow! And your car starts shaking. Well, there's a response required there. You've got to do something. And what is the fitting response? Press down on the gas? Hope you can get home before it goes flat. Well, it's already flat. So the fitting response is let off the gas and pull over off the main thoroughfare so you can stop, because you've got a tire that's flat. That's all it means to be worthy. It means it fits. Well, in the fitting issue of a life that's worthy of God means, since God is the one who's calling you into his kingdom and his glory, then the life needs to be suitable to a summons to the kingdom, a summons to the glory. That's the basic idea. And the idea of worthiness has several elements in it in this text. And we're still wondering, how do I hear this call and what do I do with it? Well, in the first place, the issue of worthiness has to begin with what God is doing, and that is calling. So, the worthy response, the life that's worthy of God who calls, is a life that responds to the voice of God however it comes, whatever it has in terms of context or content. In other words, a worthy response is, you're going to do what you're summoned to do. And the bottom line of a summons is you either believe it and operate according to the faith in it, or you reject it and operate according to your rejection concept. So, for example, if God says, if the voice of God says, get out of the house, it's on fire. You don't smell any smoke, you don't see any evidence, you don't hear any crackling, you don't feel any heat, you think, that wasn't the voice of God. And you sit there. Well, what is that? That's unbelief. You didn't act. So if you didn't act, you didn't believe it. I mean, a lot of people think that they can believe something and it doesn't create a response. That's not true. You haven't believed something that you don't respond to. So if God says, get out of the house, it's on fire, you get up and go out of the house. And then you walk around to find out where the fire is, because you believe that the house is on fire. Or you dial 911. That would even be more faith, because you haven't even seen the smoke or smelled the heat or smelled the smoke or felt the heat, but you're still dialing 911 because God said the house is on fire. That would be a little bit more remarkable level of faith, but nonetheless, you're acting because you believe something. That means then that if God is calling on a regular basis, He's got to be saying something on a regular basis that He expects us to respond to positively. He expects us to believe Him, or whatever that summons is. And the worthiness of the walk, or the worthiness of a life, assumes that the response is faith. You are going to believe. There isn't any other response worthy of the calling. You can't walk worthy if you're not going to trust. If God is calling us on a regular basis, the only thing we can do is believe Him, and that means we're walking worthy. If we say at any point, no, then we're not walking worthy anymore. We're not fitting the circumstance. Okay, so that's the first issue in worthiness, is it's got to be a response of faith. All right, then let's just ask this question. What is God saying when He calls us on a regular basis? He's got to be asking us to trust Him, doesn't He? Isn't that the bottom line of the summons? I have decided that this is what God says 24/7. Are you going to trust me in this or not? I think that's the call. You face a multitude of circumstances every day. Some of them fit exactly what you wanted to happen. That's your love. And they fit your expectation because of what you believe. So your faith and love are in harmony with the circumstance. And you don't even think about it. This is automatic. You just go. Because it's already fitting your values and your beliefs. So you don't see that as a summons to God. Are you going to trust me in this? Because you already are. I mean, your values and your beliefs are already in line with what you think God would say anyway. So you're not expecting to hear anything from Him because the circumstances are already flowing the way you think they ought to. The problem is that on any given day, something will happen that you didn't want to happen. And that's going to violate your love system. Because you didn't want it to happen. If you'd wanted it to, it would have been in that value system that you were holding on to. And because it doesn't fit, you're in a quandary now because something has happened you didn't want to happen. And that's where you have to come up with this faith thing. Because your love has been contradicted. God has allowed some kind of circumstance that contradicts what you wanted to happen, and now you've got to decide what you're going to do about that. And that's when you hear the voice of God saying, are you going to trust me or not? It's not going to be audible. It's not even going to pop in your head unless it does after this class. But the fact is, that's God's constant question. In every circumstance of our life, including the ones that we think are fitting the love and faith issues, in all of those, God is saying to us, are you going to trust me or not? Because that is the bottom line. We have to be willing to fall back on what we already know from the Word of God. In every circumstance, God works everything out for good for those who love Him. And because He's made that kind of commitment, there is no circumstance that comes into my situation that God has left me high and dry in that He wants me to figure out how to handle this. There is none. He just simply says, trust me. He may not tell us anything about it. He may not give us any specific direction. But if we're trusting, what happens? The Spirit of God is working in our hearts and minds. Faith allows the Spirit of God to produce the response that Jesus would give if he were here, because it's the Spirit of Jesus in this body. Which means that I have to have this confidence all the time. That God is at work in my heart to make me value the things that are valuable, and he's working in my mind to give me understanding of the truth so I can believe the things that are true. And this is his domain. His domain is my heart and my mind. And if I'm dependent on him to produce the values and the beliefs that are necessary for the life to be produced so that I'm walking worthy, that's his job. All my job is to trust him, to do that. And so, on a regular basis, day in and day out, we need to be involved in the concept that God's job is to alter the values of our hearts to where they suit his, alter the thinking of our minds until they fit the truth, and that's his commitment to us as his children. So as we are committed to the fact that he's working in our hearts and minds, even when we don't know it, even when we can't tell it, even when we can't feel those funny, you know, that people are always looking for some kind of a physical phenomenal thing to prove that God's working, and he doesn't give that proof 99% of the time. Once in a while, you'll have an experience that says, wow, that was God. But for the most part, your life goes along, well, what's he doing in the middle of it? He's working in your heart and in your mind. And every time you run into a circumstance you don't like or don't understand, his summons is this. Are you going to trust me in this or not? That's the question. And it doesn't have to come audibly. It doesn't even have to pop in your brain. If you understand the promise that God has made, he's committed himself to you, you just either depend on that or you don't. And that's his summons. If you're going to walk worthy, a worthy walk is a walk of responding by confidence. The question or the summons then is always the same. Are you going to trust me in this or not? Are you going to trust me in this or not? In some of those circumstances, you'll know what the Bible says about that kind of circumstance, and trust will mean you will depend on God to do what his word says in that kind of circumstance. But there's a whole lot of circumstances alive that the Bible doesn't directly address. And it's in those where we get in a quandary and we get all bent out of shape. And God is saying, are you going to trust me or not? So that's the summons. I think that's what it means, that he is calling us. And what is the consequence of responding, yes, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to trust God here. Yes, I'm going to trust you. Yes, I'm going to trust. What's the outcome of that? Well, think about it. What are the issues of a worthy walk when worthiness is defined in terms of trusting? I'm going to trust you. I'm going to depend on you to do what you said you'd do. Even if I don't know what you've said, I'm still going to depend on you to be addressing my heart and mind so that I come to grips with what you have said. What's involved in that? Well, I'd like to suggest that the preceding activities of a father, as defined in verse 12, you know, or verse 11 and 12, you know how we dealt with you as a father deals with his own children. We'll put a capital F on that. The father deals with his own children. And what is it? What's involved? He's summoning, he's comforting, and he's telling you the stories, informing you of the stories. Well, what's the only worthy response to a summons? Come! If the summons is, come stand by me, then the only worthy response is a faith response that says, okay, I'm over here now. What next? The only worthy response to comfort or consolation, the second thing that a father does to his children, is to believe that the God of all comfort is involved in the situation so that he begins to heal the hole in your soul that's been created that the comfort is designed to address. You don't need to be comforted when you're not hurting. But if you're hurting, then you have to fall back on the fact that God is the God of all comfort, and that means he's got an answer for this. And what's the summons? What's the only legitimate summons to comfort that God offers? Oh, he doesn't really care about me, or this wouldn't be happening. No, that ain't legitimate. The only legitimate response is, man, if God has allowed this hole to be ripped into my soul, he must have an answer for it, and I'm going to depend on him to produce it. That's the only legitimate response. That's faith. And what is the only worthy response of the issue that we talked about last night in urging you? That's the telling of the stories. That's reminding you of the things that have been in the past. What's the only legitimate response to being reminded of something that's happened in the past that bears some pertinence to the present? You know, most of our experiences are repetitive. We very seldom have a brand new experience that we've never had any experience of before. Most of them are, there may be some nuances of difference, but since there's only three things in the whole world anyway, there's only, at root, there's only three things, but the variations are multiplied. So there's always going to be something in our past that says, oh, I trusted God for that in the past, and He came through, so I can trust Him now, too. That's the only legitimate, worthy response. So in every case, the worthy response is, yeah, I'm going to trust you. So in a very real sense, every event of our lives, every moment as we're living, we're facing circumstances in which there's this built-in question. Are you going to trust Him in this or not? He's calling us. That's His question in the summons. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me. And if we don't, then we suffer the consequences of rejection of truth and the consequences of unbelief. But how does that work in the bigger picture of the kingdom and the glory? Well, God has, from the very beginning, had a plan for a kingdom for His dear Son. And because His Son was willing to come into the world and die for sinners, the sins of all of humanity, of all of time, pay an enormous price, insert death into the very essence of the God of life, a consequence that I don't think is ever going to be over. When you do something to the infinite God, it's done. And the ripples go through infinity. God never escapes what He's done when He created. The consequences roll through Him infinitely because He's infinite. So the price that Jesus paid has never been... We get cut, it hurts, then we grow a scab, and then everything heals. Not so with God. He never forgets. There's no diminishing of the pain by the lack of memory or the loss of memory or any of that kind of stuff. It's all fresh, all now, the infinite now. So when the Son of God said, okay, I'll buy into this plan to where we insert death into our own existence for the sake of these pathetic creatures who we've made who won't trust us. They don't love us, they don't trust us, but we're going to do this anyway. When the Son did that, the Father said, well, given that you're going to do that, I'm going to make you the king of the kingdom. I'm going to exalt your name high above every name that's named, and you're going to be the king. You're going to be the Christ. This is going to be a kingdom, and the kingdom is the kingdom of the Christ, and the summons of God, are you going to trust me in this or not, has a direct effect on our participation in the kingdom. Because the kingdom's been a plan for a long time, but all the preparation for it is now. The future is going to be, but the preparation is now. And Peter taught that in 2 Peter. The idea that in your faith add this, and in this add this, and in this add this, and in this add this. You're building toward the kingdom by letting God develop you as a believer into a mature saint. And at stake in all of that is this thing that I call the relative position or the relative participation that you can have in the kingdom. The kingdom is a large thing, and Paul said, in a large house there are many vessels, some to honor, some to dishonor. If you purge yourself from the vessels of dishonor, you'll be a vessel of honor. Well, he's talking in a very real metaphor about the magnitude of the kingdom. And in the kingdom, there are a gazillion opportunities for service because it's a servant kingdom. And where God's going to plug us into His servant kingdom is directly dependent on how well we heard and responded while we were here. If you want to be great in the kingdom, Jesus told His disciples, you're going to have to learn to be a servant of all. Well, that's not an easy lesson to learn, and it'll take you your whole lifetime to always submit your desires and your wishes under the needs that are presented before you. Always putting yours under that. That's a lifelong lesson. But the people who are skilled in hearing God say, are you going to trust me in this or not? Those are the people who are learning how to let God use their bodies to present the life of Jesus to others, to minister to those others. And when the judgment seat of Christ is set up, the positions those people take in the kingdom will be not high, glorious positions of domination, but they'll be low, glorious positions of service. So that the greater you learn, the more you learn to serve, the greater your service will be forever. That's the summons into the kingdom. And then the glory, the idea of being called into his glory, not just his kingdom, but his glory. Glory is the essence of a thing. The glory of a thing is its essence. The glory of God is things like omniscience and omnipotence and wisdom and justice and mercy and all of those. Those are his glory. And what does it mean to be summoned into that? Well, it means that you're going to take an active participatory place in exercising wisdom and knowledge and power and justice and mercy and all those kind of things. Because the essence of life is the ability to experience what it means to possess the character of God. That's why life eternal is defined as knowing God and his Son Jesus Christ in John 17:3. This is life eternal, that they might know you and your Son Jesus. So the better you get to know him, the more you participate in his way of thinking about things, the more his love dominates your heart and his thoughts dominate your mind, and you become an active participant in the glory of God. You begin to think like he thinks and love like he loves, and you start being like him. And that's a summons into the glory. And keep this in mind. Paul said, the glory that is to be revealed is not worthy to be compared to anything you have to put up with down here. Which means that the payoff of saying yes when he says, are you going to trust me in this? The payoff is always in terms of magnitude beyond your ability to figure it out. Incomparable means you've got nothing to compare it to. So a little bit of yes now will blow up into enormous participation glory then. So when God calls us, he says, are you going to trust me in this? You can say no. But when you do, you blow off a whole possibility of enormous glory, because you don't trust, you don't get the glory. You also diminish your participation in the kingdom, because saying no to the chief servant means that you're not learning how to serve. And that means you're going to be served. And that means you're going to be moved up in the kingdom to the position of being served rather than servant in a kingdom of servants. That's not a good thing. You're not going to feel good about that, even though everybody in the kingdom is serving you. So the point, I believe, of verse 12 is we are by the Father, we are called alongside, we are comforted, we are given the stories so that we can live a life that's worthy of the God who is calling us into his kingdom and his glory. His summons is, are you going to trust me here? And if we say yes, our position in the kingdom is moved downward in the sense of a greater position of service, and our participation in his own character is exploded beyond comprehension. That's his summons to us. Are you going to trust me? Quite a calling. And I really think that that's what he's trying to... That's why he wrote the book of 1 Thessalonians, because maintaining a vibrant hope in the coming of Jesus from heaven is fundamental to being able to live a stable life here and say, yes, I'm going to trust you. Yes, I'm going to trust you. Yes, I'm going to trust you. And it really doesn't matter what the circumstance is. He's bigger than all of them anyway.